Hello, welcome back to another episode of the Code 321 podcast. I'm here with Dr. Kennedy. Thank you for joining me today. I appreciate you having me over.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So if you don't mind, if you want to tell the listeners just a little bit about how you found your way to toxicology and then a little bit about what you're doing now, that would be awesome.
Yeah, that's a great start. So my path to toxicology started in emergency medicine, and most toxicologists, not all, come from an EM background. There's a handful that come from internal medicine or from pediatrics, occupational medicine as well. So it is a good collection of subspecialists that are not all from, you know, the emergency background, but a sizable chunk of us are. And I had a mentor in residency, a fantastic guy, Tim Erickson, who's still down at the Brigham and Women's Hospital as an attending there. And I just thought he was one of the best doctors I'd ever met, sharp as a tack, but just, you know, really, really witty, took real good care of patients. And there was so much about toxicology that I think just made him and makes most toxicologists better emergency doctors. And I thought it would be a really cool career path. And, you know, Tim and several other folks were pretty instrumental in helping me, you know, realize I could pursue a fellowship. And so I ended up traveling, spent a couple of years out at Cook County Hospital and the University of Illinois in Chicago, completing training, and then moved back here to Vermont. And so that's kind of how I ended up here, how I ended up in my kitchen with you today.
Yes. So did you go through residency as an EM resident and then do a fellowship in toxicology?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
There's so within emergency medicine residencies, there are a handful of required and elective rotations, and one of them is toxicology. So as residents, we spent time at the Massachusetts and Rhode Island Poison Center. It's a really fun part of the job is getting kind of like, you know, with EMS ride-alongs.
Yeah.
We got to sit kind of in the den where all the pharmacists and nurses are manning the phones and answering phone calls at poison control. And, you know, it's a lot like any call center. But, you know, when you're exposed to hearing the calls firsthand, it's completely different than being in the emergency department where somebody's been triaged and you have more information. You know, you have these folks at poison center who are really just fielding sometimes phone calls from really exasperated folks. And if they need help, if they need backup, they go to a medical toxicologist, which is what I am. So that's the kind of physician or usually a pharmacist with really advanced training. We're the backup for those really sick, critically ill patients.
I've definitely told everyone that will listen how much of a fan I am of the poison control hotline. Because when I first started in this career field as like an EMT and an AEMT, I always assumed it was like some sort of national, you know, 188 where you call and you get a menu and you push a button and you do this and you do that and you kind of get generic responses. And so I never really accessed it. And then I had a complicated overdose patient on prescription medication that I wasn't familiar with. And I called and it was like, are you a healthcare provider? And I was like, yep. So I pressed one and it was phenomenal. And ever since then, anytime I have any overdose of any kind, anytime I was precepting or working by myself or whatever, I always called them because it's phenomenal. It's like talking to somebody like you on the phone.
Oh, you'll learn something every time.
Oh, 100%.
And the other thing that's really important is the kind of continuity of care that happens. And so I you know, I'm thrilled to be on the podcast, but a kind of a special interest of mine is trying to reach any pre-hospital or inter-facility provider, you know, EMT, to maybe even just a police officer who's at the roadside at the, you know, yeah, initiation of a case. But we've had calls, we get calls from everywhere. And so much of the information that I need as a toxicologist is about the scene and the ingestion, right?
Oh,
like
yeah.
What did it look like? What bottles did you find? Anything you can do to gather information. And sometimes I've had a couple of cases just cracked wide open because a very thoughtful medic took a quick photo of this product that was, you know, one example that sticks in my mind, this product 1,4-butanediol, which is, you know, it used to be labeled or sold as like a printer cleaner, a VHS cleaner, just
yeah,
illicitly, but it basically is metabolized to GHB. So it, you know, just gets people very pleasantly inebriated,
yeah,
and high, but you can buy this stuff in industrial bottles.
Yeah.
And, you know, EMS picked up a guy with, you know, he was just obtunded, not even sternal rub, like, you know, completely areflexic, intubated without meds type of unresponsive. And the medic snapped a photo of this solution. And that was the only data we had to kind of guide or help us figure out what was going on. So any chance I can get to get in touch with people, like, you know, the second they show up or even en route, is really helpful. So we love those calls. Keep them coming.
Definitely. No, and they're so helpful. I used to kind of joke that a lot of my patients, you know, with these crazy ingestions and seizure activity, that they tend to recommend like benzodiazepines a lot, which is something that we actually do carry that we give frequently. Joke, I know, which is good. And one of the things that I remember specifically is I called and this patient, you know, had ingested something, and one of the people on the poison control line is like, they're going to stop breathing in the next 15 minutes or so. So you should be ready for that. And sure enough, ended up intubating the patient about 20 minutes later pre-hospitally. And it was so helpful to know that, because I never would have been able to look at that medication and made that correlation, and to have them be like, do you have intubation equipment? Yeah, you should get that ready.
Yeah.
That was really helpful.
There are sometimes you kind of know for certain. A call I took care of, you know, took the other day was a small critical access hospital in New Hampshire. And it was a woman who initially drank a lot of alcohol, but took a, you know, kind of a grab bag of antidepressants and ingested them. And I was going through the list with the doc at this facility, and one of them was bupropion, which, you know, among everything else, the kind of alphabet soup of SSRIs and other ones, that's one I really worry about. And I told the doc, I said, if that bottle's empty and her vitals are, you know, she was tachycardic and getting a little sleepy, I said, she's going to have a seizure. I can't guarantee it, but it's going to happen. Yeah. Okay. And I know she's stable now, but like things are going to get worse. And I promise you they're going to get worse, and you don't want to be alone. So start making phone calls, thinking about transfer, let the transport team know to have, you know, anti-seizure medications. And so that's a lot of what we do, is trying to forecast and plan and prepare for the worst. It's kind of, you know, just a more of an extension of what we do naturally anyways. And, you know, in EMS and EM in general.
Yeah, no, that's really fascinating. I've always been interested in toxicology, because it's like, it feels like it's the blend between like biology and chemistry and like environmental things and like all these crazy cases. And there's so many podcasts and movies and, you know, things like that, you know, where people have these crazy experiences and get ingestions of various things. And it's just so fascinating. So can you share with me a little bit about, let's say I'm a paramedic or an EMT and I go to a patient, and let's just use like the broad term of altered mental status, a patient who's not acting appropriately, and they roll in. Is there any kind of standardized approach that you start with, just some basic ground balls about how to start figuring out maybe what's going on? Is this tox? Is this medical? Like, how do you approach a patient that's, let's say, not able to tell you their name? Maybe they're a little bit obtunded and they're difficult to communicate with.
Yeah, that's already a lot of good information to start with there. It's funny, one of my pet peeves is probably the term altered mental status in general. And, you know, I've kind of been on a crusade to try and, you know, just, are there ways to think about refining that term a bit, right?
Yeah,
because it's often used as a triage term or a check-in or something like that, but there's so much more to it, right? They're people who are hyperactive, right? They have kind of an agitated, you know, presentation sometimes. Sometimes they're just hyperactive, but in a really good mood. And that's a whole separate type. Sometimes they're really sleepy, right?
Yeah.
They're sleepy. There's kind of like, okay, you know, they're laying there. They're not interfering with care. And,
yeah.
And that's the type that generally most people are happy with. But, you know, then it borders on, okay, well, you're not breathing, or you are just, like we talked about earlier, a big baclofen overdose or GHB, some of these agents that just, they will render people essentially, you know, brain dead, for better or worse. But I don't know, my 60-second approach, right? If I, you know, right when I get to the head of the bed as a, or foot of the bed, wherever you're standing as an ED doc and as a toxicologist, I'll generally look first, like anyone else, you know, what's the respiratory effort? And I want to know that, because my first intervention would probably be thinking about what are immediately reversible things, or more importantly, what can I do to support somebody who's really sick and not actively breathing? And oftentimes that comes down to just being quick enough to think about BVM, you know, bag valve mask rescue. And even before, you know, there's such a kind of knee-jerk reaction in many situations to just give naloxone, given, you know, the opioid epidemic we're dealing with. But I think remembering that a lot of the problems you can bag your way through while you're thinking is a helpful first bet. I'll quickly look at the pupils too. And again, this is just the first 10 to 15 second overview. I'll open the eyes, look at the pupils. If it's somebody, you know, bordering on somnolent to obtunded, I think a real nice trick as far as eliciting a kind of a response to stimuli, either simple nail bed pressure, sternal pressure, and then again, just jaw thrusting as probably the most noxious of stimuli. But you get a sense for how obtunded somebody is very quickly with just a you know, doesn't even have to be aggressive, but just a gentle jaw thrust. And then other things, we call it the tox handshake, but, you know, take your hand, maybe a gloved hand, and shove it in the armpit. Somebody, for example, with a big cocaine or methamphetamine overdose, a big sympathomimetic, will, you know, they'll be kind of sweaty.
Oh, definitely. Armpits. Yeah.
You think about diphenhydramine or Benadryl, for example, Jimson weed, devil's trumpet, some of these other anticholinergic plants. You know, I've seen pre-hospital atropine overdoses too, actually, from EMS teams that have taken people who are so bradycardic, giving them 7, 8, 9, 10 milligrams of atropine, and they end up dilated pupils and, you'll feel nice dry armpits.
Yeah.
So yeah, usually a good skin exam, skin, pupils, respiratory effort. And then, you know, obviously just, I think, derobing somebody and making sure they're not covered in any patches or are their clothes soaked with any chemical, for example. So quickly eliminating any external stuff. But that's probably the first, 45 to 60 seconds of a tox focused resuscitation in my mind.
Yeah. And I think the really fascinating thing about what you just said is anyone from an EMT up through a paramedic could do all of those things. Mm-hmm. On the scene, you know, like that. It's not like you're saying, well, I would draw this extremely complicated chemistry panel to determine the appropriate enzymes. Like, you're just talking about a good physical exam.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the interesting things that
abbreviated, right?
Oh, that's right.
But at the same time, it's like, this is 30 seconds of work. It's
exactly.
Let's
get some basic information. There's a really good chart I've used before with some toxicology lectures that has all the different types of, you know, overdoses, and it has, you know, a picture of a guy sweating and a picture of a guy that's dry, you know, big pupils, little pupils, fast heart rate, slow heart rate, respirations, depressed, not depressed. And I think that's really helpful for providers to kind of have some level of understanding of what you might be seeing. There's all these mnemonics like, you know, the mad as a hatter, dry as a bone, blind as a bat. And one of the things I've noticed is that sometimes, you know, when I was working 911 as a paramedic, we'd get called for intercepts for really sick patients.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't necessarily that that patient needed an immediate paramedic level intervention. It's that the advantage that paramedics have over some other providers is the schooling is a lot longer. And then you have the opportunity to do rotations with like doctors like yourself. Like we're able to go into the hospital and participate with these physical exams.
Spending the summer with us at UVM, which would be great.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. So I think it's really fascinating that you said, you know, some of those initial tests. I mean, this is stuff we can all do just as a quick check, which is really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So you go through that, and let's say that you know, maybe you notice a few things. Maybe the respiratory rate is depressed. It's not responsive to naloxone. You're bagging them. They need additional respiratory support. You've done kind of that 30-second assessment. What would be like the 201 level toxicology screening that you would start doing? Is this when you would start thinking about like labs or some other types of interventions to see what we can see here? Or is it kind of going to depend on the patient's response to your interventions?
That's a great question. I think a lot of it's very context dependent, right? So, you know, if you have some history that this patient, for example, is prescribed gabapentin, maybe, or baclofen, or some of these drugs that are likely to lead to eventually being obtunded.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're at the point where you're bagging them, then just intubate them and move on.
That's right.
I mean, it's
isolate just the trachea for sure.
It fixes most of those problems. And, you know, there are other sometimes direct reversal agents. I think of, you know, naloxone's a good example of an analeptic or, you know, an awakening agent, a reversal agent that has a lot of properties that are kind of outside of just opioids themselves. It can reverse CNS depression from many causes.
Mm.
Ibuprofen overdoses, interestingly. People don't think about most people think of them as like, you know, big old nothing burgers. But if like a toddler, for example, gets into a whole bottle of ibuprofen, a lot of it, for example, or a teenager overdoses on it, it can actually be a pretty potent CNS depressant.
Mm.
And so in large amounts, and there's some literature supporting that you can use naloxone to reverse that. Even people with, you know, spontaneous intracranial hemorrhages, they're, you know, to a lesser extent, alcohol ingestion, but naloxone will wake people up to varying extent. Flumazenil is another good example. You know, we use that as a benzodiazepine overdose reversal agent, mostly like in the hospital if people are too sedated. But, you know, there's probably going to be a growing role for it with some of these other, you know, other drugs in the market too. We're seeing a lot of kind of novel benzodiazepines that are making their way into, especially the kind of like 18 to 25 year old male range. We've, you know, had a number of cases come in too. So, I mean, if you get context, if you get background about cases or information, or you can scan someone's med list, then you can start targeted stuff. But
yeah,
otherwise I'm just going to intubate them.
Yeah, there you go. Save that trachea for sure.
And then, you know, downstream, the downstream toxicologist in me thinks about what do we do afterwards for kind of broadening and you know, projecting and planning, like how long is this going to be a problem for? Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of these poisons, especially in large amounts, can be brain death mimics where people will be, you know, completely unresponsive off sedation for days at a time, to the point where, I mean, baclofen, I think the probably most famous case was a patient who had overdosed on it, was on their way to the operating room for organ harvesting after being declared brain dead, and then started to wake up on the OR table.
Wow.
So yeah, there's and a lot of good position statements on, you know, evaluating brain death and some of these overdoses, but they can be pretty potent. So,
yeah. Oh man, that's nuts. Well, I'm going to see if I can challenge you here real quick, just for my own fascination. Sure, yeah. I'm sure this is like your bread and butter, but I've always been so interested. I've had many an aspirin overdose in my life, in my 911 career, people who are doing SI. And one of the fascinating things that I remember about aspirin is at different points in its toxicology, doesn't it have both a alkali state and an acidotic state that people can run through?
Yeah.
Something like that.
I mean, there is kind of a classic triple acid based disorder associated with it, but you know, in reality, there's always so much overlap to these things, right? And the big problem, I mean, so, you know, salicylates or salicylic acid, right? Is a, you know, it's an acid in and of itself. But you know, when it ends up entering tissues, it can be really problematic, and kind of as the pH drives lower, more of it gets dumped into tissues too. And while it's doing that, it starts to stimulate the respiratory center. So people develop this, you know, really not like a classic diabetic Kussmaul breathing, but you'll see this pattern of hyperpnea, right? So big, deep breaths, pulling a lot of tidal volume.
Definitely.
And the kind of classic toxidrome for like a salicylate poison patient would be somebody who is confused, I won't say altered, but usually, you know, it can vary between a mix of kind of mild agitation and delirium all the way to eventually getting progressively more somnolent, but they'll be hyperpneic. They're, you know, that respiratory center stimulated. They're breathing off some of that carbon dioxide too, to try and correct their pH on their own. They'll be a little tachycardic. Oftentimes because of some of the uncoupling that happens, they'll be a little diaphoretic too. But they're really tough cases to manage. And you know, people tend to underestimate how sick a salicylate poison patient can get and how much attention they really need. They need a lot of, you know, kind of at least one-to-one nursing while they're really ill, and a lot of attention to the labs and managing pH and all that. So I'm sorry you've got to deal with them. They're uniformly, they're a lot of fun to think through, but they're nightmare cases because so much can go wrong and often does.
Oh yeah. No. I think the overdose cases were always fascinating to me when I was working 911, because it was the only time I felt like a detective, you know, like, especially if there was multiple medics on the crew, they'd be managing the patient. It's like, all right, we're going to go on a hunt now. We're going to go look at the trash, the bathroom trash, look in the cupboard,
absolutely.
You know,
and open that medicine cabinet, look in the lock boxes.
You know,
well, the big thing too, you see a 7-day supply of pills, right? So a lot of, you know, especially our very geriatric population here in Vermont, they'll take their entire weekly pill planner and sometimes open all 7 days like an advent calendar, just going fishing for that chocolate and just garble down a whole week's worth of meds. And if you're old and sick enough, even that amount can be lethal.
Yeah. I still remember my very first, elderly opiate overdose. Threw me off. It took me and my partner probably like 20 minutes to pick up on the fact that we were bagging and doing all the normal things and supplying supportive care. And, you know, we worked through the ABCs appropriately. So we were managing the patient, but I remember someone in the crew being like, do you want to try some naloxone? We have pinpoint pupils and respiratory depression. And we ended up waking the patient up and talking to them about it. And they take opiates for chronic pain, and they took too many opiates and they didn't have anything to eat. And they just had this massive overdose. And I was like, at the time, the only opiate patients we were really seeing were a lot of illicit opiate use or opiate abuse at that time. This was like 10 years ago or so. And so just, it's funny how changing the environment you're in can almost like throw you off a little bit. Like it wasn't like we were at the bus station or at, you know, a bathroom at a local fast food chain. We were just in some nice
house.
Yeah. And yeah. It was like, so not pigeonholing yourself into, you know, letting this.
Well, it speaks to the problem of the opioid epidemic too, and how it's, you know, essentially touched everyone's life in some way or another, either personally or professionally. It's not the same landscape of, you know, kind of like you said, young folks using heroin, like it used to be in the 80s. It's everywhere.
And
pill and snorting, injecting, you name it. So I think, it also speaks to just how the landscape's changed when you think about the use of pre-hospital naloxone, right? I mean, having some of these antidotes, so widely available, publicly deployed, having, having police and other, you know, even like lay responders, trained in administering antidotes for poisons is kind of a novel thing in toxicology. I don't know if 20, 30 years ago, it seems so normal now, right?
But, I know.
But back in the 90s, that was not how the world was.
I think we're a lot more medically inclined in general as a society. I mean, you have people doing bleeding control, stop the bleed. They're doing bystander CPR. Some are even doing ventilations with pocket masks at schools now. They're doing EpiPen administration. And these are not, you know, camp counselors or camp nurses. These are just normal everyday teachers, you know? Yeah. And so I think it's fascinating that we've kind of almost like this, you know, Red Cross or AHA style first aid programs are now kind of like the standard of societal care. I can't remember the last time I went to a cardiac arrest in a public setting that where the person was not receiving some level of care, even if it was poor care, you know, it was still people knew what needed to happen, you know, and someone did something. And almost every code save I can think about had bystander CPR to the point where we just have to give them a shock or two, maybe give a little ventilations, maybe a little one dose of epi, and you know, it's no problem. So it's really fascinating to see that. And then making sure that as a 911 provider, you really pump those people up, you know, like, hey, you know, if they get the resuscitation, hey, you saved this person. Like, we didn't do anything. You did all the hard work, you know? And
well, it reminds me, I think there's some study or, you know, literature out of the EM group down in Brigham and Women's looking at the cardiac arrest survival rates at Gillette Stadium.
Oh yeah.
Which are something like 4 or 5 times higher than the national average, because you've got a bunch of, you know, generally, I'll say, you know, well-educated, albeit rowdy, Bostonians.
That's right.
who are all at Gillette, but all of them, right? Same thing. It's that the one thing you see there, it's a sick population, 64,000 people all, you know, cheering, eating fatty food and drinking beer. And so the incidence of cardiac arrest is decent at these football games, but everyone there know there's defibrillators everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, medics essentially on site and field docs, but everyone in the stands essentially knows CPR and, you know, uniformly patients who end up with some sort of a VT, VF arrest or a shockable arrest in football stadiums and just stadiums in general do better.
Yeah.
And which it seemed counterintuitive to me at first. And then I'm like, oh no, this is perfect. You've got 10 seconds at most of downtime before somebody's hands are on chest and starting, you know, hopefully high quality CPR.
Something. Some CPR.
I know with a number of overdoses in the world too. I think it's part of the idea of just getting the naloxone everywhere, right?
Yeah.
It's got to be something immediately available. And even if you overdo it and somebody ends up in withdrawal afterwards, we're even looking at options for treating withdrawal precipitated by naloxone, which is another fascinating pre-hospital intervention.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know, in Vermont, at least, and some other parts of the country, we're using buprenorphine in the pre-hospital setting is just one of those things that's like a decade ago seemed unfathomable.
Yeah, it's so wild. Yeah. I remember we got from the State Department of Health when I was working in downtown Burlington, we got a big pallet filled with these, you know, opiate resuscitation rescue kits, and every, you know, some places got a couple boxes of it, and Burlington gets a huge pallet. So within like 2 months, the whole thing was gone. And the health department's like, you went through all that stuff? And we're like, yeah.
Yeah.
People want this
When's
stuff.
When's the next pallet?
You know, and it's like, and the folks want this, you know, people who are using the drugs want it. Their family and friends want it. Bystanders want it. People who work in downtown businesses want it because they're experiencing this. And like you said, it's touching everybody, and you know, people are running into this. So, so just to kind of tie all these different threads together, do you want to share maybe like a case that came in that's relatively interesting and talk a little bit about, you know, how you approached assessment of it, how you made some decisions on treatment, and ultimately kind of what the disposition was?
Yeah, actually, I could think of one from a while ago. I we'll try to avoid any specifics, but
yeah.
It was a teenager who presented to a critical access hospital. Again, one of these, you know, I think these smaller hospitals, there's one I work at, in New York that, you know, when I'm there, I'm the only doctor in the entire hospital.
That's right.
There's no other physician.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I love it there. It's kind of like just practicing medicine. I think the, you know, the way it should be, and it forces you to get creative, but there are still a lot of these hospitals in America, that are losing support from specialists, or they might be, you know, that had formerly had an obstetrics department, for example, that shut down. Mm-hmm. But a lot of rural hospitals are ending up in the scenario where there's really no one but maybe a single ER doc or a family doc around in the day or at night. And so a patient presented to one of these hospitals, this teenager, saying she had eaten some mushrooms to get high, is all that we had heard. And she came in, by the time I think EMS was called, she arrived tachycardic, confused, not really following commands, picking at things, spaced out looking, as it were. And the team had a lot of difficulty trying to essentially, you know, get the situation calm enough to where they could get IV access, try to get a urine sample for like a urine drug screen, for example. She was just interfering with care, is a good way to put about it. Just generally swatting nurses away, you know, ripping telemetry leads off, and those ones are really tough to take care of. So, you know, when we think about mushrooms, there's many different types. For example, there's, you know, psilocybin containing psychedelic mushrooms. You have gyromitra mushrooms, for example, which can lead to seizures. Outside of the hallucinogenic ones, there are plenty of delicious ones too. And so there, we could do a whole podcast on mushrooms alone. And some of them can make you behave with this kind of delirium where you're acting squirrely. And so, you know, there was nothing really like immediately life-threatening. No, again, like no problems with the ABCs. And oftentimes, if it's just a, you know, a presentation like this, just put the patient in a dark room, minimize stimuli, and let them sleep it off. So the problem came in the next morning, right? It was a change of shift, and the girl had not really improved overnight. She was still, I think when they checked her vitals again, still tachycardic, about 130, 140, had an episode of incontinence overnight, which again, kind of unusual for a mushroom ingestion, hadn't had anything to eat or drink, and was still just, you know, very much confused, getting a little more combative actually. Mm. And so the decision was made then to transfer the patient to a higher level of care, to a pediatrics hospital, thinking, you know, she'd probably need some observation or admission, and ended up getting sent to our tertiary hospital, where she continued to deteriorate and then eventually had a seizure. Mm. And when she had a seizure, the team was able to obtain IV access, and they put a Foley catheter in after realizing that her bladder had about 2 liters of urine in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so kind of unusual,
seems
right?
Like a lot, yeah.
And after the seizure, so let's go through this case, right?
Yeah.
I give you, let's say we only have 60 seconds, right? She's post-ictal, but not interfering with anyone. If you have 60 seconds, what are the things that we want to look at on that kind of initial exam, right? We talked about pupils.
Pupils, yeah.
So her pupils were about 8-9 millimeter saucers, really dilated.
Large.
Tox handshake, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Those armpits were just dry, 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 dry.
Yeah.
Nothing at all. Still tachycardic, probably 135, 140 at that point. So we start to kind of think like, oh, this is not a normal presentation, but there is a bit of a toxidrome here, right? That kind of like
for
mad
sure.
as a hatter,
yeah.
dry as a beet.
Yeah.
So she had actually classic anticholinergic toxicity. And upon looking at the urine drug screen, there was a positive result for tricyclic antidepressants, which is one that isn't included on most of our modern urine drug screens, but there are some that still include it. And so that kind of led to our team having a bit of a hypothesis that, oh, what if this was a diphenhydramine ingestion? What if it's not mushrooms at all? And this was just a, you know, a teenager taking some Benadryl, trying to get high, you know, like the latest TikTok challenge or whatever.
Yeah.
And, ultimately, that ended up being the case. So, you know, we gave benzodiazepines just to kind of correct the heart rate a bit. And, you know, once the post-ictal state resolved, she was back and agitated. Unfortunately, our kind of favorite antidote for this, physostigmine, has been on national back order for the last couple of years.
Oh,
and we just got it back on formulary, at least at at UVM and some of our sister hospitals. But yeah, the treatment would be essentially you can immediately reverse Benadryl toxicity with physostigmine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which is very helpful.
Yeah.
I know it's wonderful. It's one of those like just watching like the sun come through the clouds.
Yeah.
The heavens open up. Like when you give this drug and it works, it's one of the most incredible things in the world because it will take somebody from this really frustratingly delirious state back to essentially, you know, lucency. And so I've given it to patients before where they will, you know, they'll present exactly like this. And then within about a minute or two, they'll be able to have a conversation with you. And you have this window where you can say like, what did you take?
Yeah.
You know, did you brew your tea with devil's trumpet?
That's right. Or, I know.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's one of those really satisfying things, but yeah, it was a really interesting case though, because everyone was kind of fixated on this, like this false history, of I ate a mushroom and it had nothing to do with that. It's just common things being common.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Benadryl, I'm sure you've seen a couple of cases too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I remember when I was working in downtown, we used to cover all the special events that would happen at the waterfront and different things like that. We'd have a contract to do medical standby, and it was almost like you could predict what types of toxidromes you were going to see based on who was playing. So, you know, we would have I remember when, you know, fish would come or like twiddle or something, we would see a lot of mushrooms, a lot of acid, like a lot of weed, that kind of thing. And then when, I forget who came down, there was a really heavy metal band that came down a couple years ago. And that was like within 10 minutes of the first set, there was a seizure. We had seizures, fights, like aggression, delirium with agitation. Like, it's just entertaining how like the style of music can kind of lead towards the different types of overdoses that we see, because they have their own cultural uses of different things.
In Chicago, I mean, that's like a mass casualty event for the EDs there.
Oh yeah.
I remember as a fellow, it's one of those things where I think like as the toxicology fellows, you're in a different scheduling pool than the rest of the faculty.
Yeah.
And everyone else knows to take that weekend off.
That's so right. I know.
I found it was like mysteriously, it seemed like all of us were always working. All the toxicologists somehow ended up on that random Saturday of Lollapalooza.
I know.
And it's just a train wreck of, you know, all sorts of, just like you said, just, you know, psychedelics and meth and ecstasy and oh my gosh.
Mix of all the above.
Yeah. I know. You said a fish concert. I'm like, oh man, yeah, break out the acid.
Oh yeah. No, it's crazy. And most of them do pretty good. And the nice thing is in those places, they're kind of as community-based as they are, they all want the person to get help. So a lot of the times they'll actually drag the person right out of the crowd to you. So you don't have to fight through, you know, 150, 300, like, you know, headbanging people, which is really helpful. But yeah, it was a good experience. You got to see a lot of different styles of people who are having a lot of different overdoses and kind of work through that process. And definitely benzos were my friend for a lot of cases that I had, people who are just really amped up, really agitated, really having a hard time, you know,
controlling. You just turn down the volume.
Just right? a little bit.
They're a great little like volume switch.
Yeah. I used to say like because we would have some different options, you know, we'd have ketamine for sedation. We'd have benzos for sedation. We've, you know, Haldol for sedation, a lot of different things that we could use based on what the patient was presenting as. And I used to describe it to new medics as like, you know, ketamine is unplugging the unbalanced washer from the wall so you can reset. And benzos is just a wet blanket just to cool it down, just smother the fire a little bit, just get us back under control.
Yeah, nice, you know? Easily titratable. Yeah. And, you know, it's for almost any you know, positive, amped up, tachycardic, that type of a toxicologic problem, they really just, I mean, I say they solve the problem at the level of the brainstem and above, right? So all the peripheral stuff, all the problems you see with a lot of different poisons, you can just kind of stop all the sympathetic outflow that happens from the brain. And that's what's really helpful. And, you know, a lot of the morbidity in these things like cocaine, methamphetamine, it comes from seizures.
Yeah.
Seizures, aspiration, and cardiovascular toxicity. And the way that you prevent a lot of that is just really, you know, judicious benzodiazepines. And sometimes it takes a lot. I mean, I've given upwards of, you know, 50 to 100 of milligrams of midazolam, lorazepam for methamphetamine cases. And fortunately, we don't see as much of that here in the Northeast as I did in the Midwest.
Yeah.
If you take somebody who's, you know, stuffing or packing a lot of cocaine or meth, then there's no upper limit. You just need what you have to.
So, I know. Yeah. It's crazy. I remember one of my most interesting cases was with Sarah Schlein, actually, who I'm sure you know.
Oh, yeah.
I had a patient who had chest pain, and I gave them everything under the sun, nitro, aspirin, you know, all kinds of meds, like high doses of all these things, and still had this crushing, uncontrollable chest pain. And it ended up being cocaine-induced vasospasm. So she gave a little bit of benzos, and the pain went away. And I was like, I never would have thought
magic
to go down that route. Yeah. Well, Joe,
Sarah's so smart. So
yeah, I appreciate you coming on the show today. Thanks for having me over, and I'm definitely getting you some of those tips that you gave us. So
my pleasure. For being here. Yeah, and reach out anytime if you need me or Poison Control, your favorite 1-800-222-1222.
Got it.
One of us is always there, ready to listen, learn, teach, whatever you need.
Yeah, I definitely encourage anybody to call if you have questions. So thanks, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thanks.